This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I mean, first of all, obviously great actor, great director, great subject matter. This will only disappoint us, probably.
My God, I hope not.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Daniel Day-Lewis of the education policy community, Kathleen Porter-McGee.
Nice, I like that reference.
Hey, you know, he's coming out in Lincoln this weekend. I'm pretty excited. I know, probably like you, as a parent, I have not seen a movie in a theater in a long time, but I have got to figure out a way to get into the theater for this one.
Yeah, Mark is super excited. He wants us definitely to go this weekend.
Yeah.
He wants to figure it out.
I mean, first of all, obviously great actor, great director, great subject matter. This will only disappoint us, probably.
My God, I hope not.
So, and why now? I mean, is there a Civil War anniversary that they're trying to link this to, or is it simply just Oscar season? This is why. I guess that's it. Okay. Lots to cover. Election roundup this week. Let's get started. Pamela's here to play Pardon the Gadfly.
In Indiana, Republican State Superintendent Tony Bennett, one of the country's biggest champions of Common Core, was unseated by a Democrat who has indicated that she would be willing to reconsider the state standards. What could this mean for the future of Common Core?
Kathleen, did this bring him down?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know all the politics behind it, but it certainly shows that the coalitions are cross party lines. Obviously, people who are on the right who support the Common Core are not going to get a ton of support from conservatives and Republicans. So they're going to have to be more creative in how they cross party lines to get support from other people. And the sense that I get is that he didn't necessarily do that.
So the question is, there's clearly are Republicans who voted for Governor Romney for president, for Mike Pence for governor of Indiana, and then voted against Tony Bennett. And the question is it because of the Common Core? Now, I have seen some data, doing some polling data and other things to try to figure out some of these questions. And it does not appear that Common Core was a big issue. You know, as far as you can tell, that you've got Republicans who have teachers and their families and their teacher spouses or teacher sisters or teacher mothers made it very clear to them that Tony Bennett is the devil and has been attacking us nonstop and that you should vote against him. That there's some evidence to that effect, that the unions especially were incredibly successful at using social media to get this word out. Not always truthful information that they got out, but to really, you know, to push back against Tony Bennett's reforms when it came to things like teacher evaluations, school vouchers, and the like. But that Common Core, not so much. But of course, the reason why this is getting so much attention is that the opponents of Common Core want to try to claim that they've got some momentum here and that they are going to be able to go to other red states and make Republicans afraid of supporting this. What do you think, Kathleen? Do you see this really finally taking flight? We're going to see some states backing out, or is it nothing's going to happen until the assessments come in, and that's when you're going to see states running away from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not really sure exactly. I mean, I think that there's going to be continued momentum, and I think when the assessments do come online, if the momentum continues as it is, you could see some states really peeling off the Common Core. Which, unfortunately, that's when the rubber meets the road, and that's when we want support to increase, because there's going to be a tough period. So yeah. Supporters need to figure this out.
You know, I almost wonder if we should allow states to go through some process where they re-up, you know, kind of like the people go and they get married again, you know, or what are those ceremonies?
Renewing their vows.
Yes, we should ask states to renew their vows and say, hey, if you want out now, it's okay. You know, no harm, no foul, you know, but you commit, especially states that have new Republican leadership, you renew your vows and demonstrate that this is something you're doing because you believe in it, not because you're being coerced into it.
You know, it's interesting because I think that one of the biggest problems is that there wasn't a lot of debate at the time when states were adopting Common Core.
Right.
And I think now we're feeling the effects of that. So maybe renewing our vows would bring up that debate, but I think you would see people peel off.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we don't want a huge divorce rate either. Okay, Pamela, topic number two.
Mike's book, The Diverse Schools Dilemma, dropped on Tuesday. Mike, what is the diverse schools dilemma?
Well, here's the dilemma. There's a lot of parents, like myself, who like the idea of sending our kids to diverse schools, especially socioeconomically diverse schools, racially diverse schools, but are worried that if our kids are going to school with a lot of poor kids, say immigrant children or other kids growing up in poverty, that those schools might be so overwhelmed by trying to serve the needs of those other kids that our own children may not get served as needed. I would say it comes down to a couple of things. One is this question of how do these diverse schools handle academic diversity. In diverse, socioeconomically diverse schools, you tend to have a huge span in terms of the achievement levels of kids, partly because of the achievement gaps. I mean, we know that more affluent kids tend to be several grade levels ahead of poor kids. There's also a racial achievement gap. You add that up, and you could have elementary schools where, you know, you've got first graders, some of whom are on a fourth or fifth grade reading level, and others are still learning their letters. How do schools deal with that? That's really challenging. The other thing is that the schools that tend to do a good job serving poor kids, the no excuses kinds of charter schools, tend to use teaching methods that are very traditional, a lot of structure. These are the kind of things that a lot of us loosey-goosey, progressive, upper middle class parents hate and don't want for our own kids. And so the dilemma is, how can we find schools that are both socioeconomically diverse, but also will serve our own kids well, will also be the kind of educational style that we will like. And it's hard. What I try to do in the book is to wrestle with this dilemma, show the pros and cons so that parents can make an informed decision. Kathleen, you know, where you've got kids who are getting close to being school age. Where do you come down on some of these issues?
I think that, well, I certainly worry about it very personally, because I don't think that schools are very good at dealing with academic diversity. And I think it too often leads to things like tracking, that means that students are still segregated just by classroom rather than by school. So I don't think that actually helps anything. I'm becoming more and more of a supporter of Carol Burris, to put in a little plug for some of the work that she's done. She actually leads a socioeconomically diverse school in New York, and she has some very interesting ideas for how to attack the academic diversity problem and how to attack it through a content-rich curriculum. And so I think that diverse schools should really look to different solutions rather than just segregating by classroom for addressing this academic diversity issue, so that all students are better served.
But do you think, people say, oh, the answer is differentiated instruction? I say in the book, you know, that is a great slogan, but it is really hard to do. And teachers, even ed school professors, admit it is hard to do.
Well, the problem is that differentiated instruction too often means that you're just constantly giving students who are behind the same content over and over again, hopefully hoping that they catch on in a different way. I think that really is about exposing all students to much more rigorous content. And there is some element of differentiation. Obviously, you need to meet students, you need to scaffold the students where they are. But I think traditionally differentiation hasn't worked well.
Are you going to choose a diverse public school where you live in Alexandria?
I don't know, actually. I mean, we don't have a lot of options, right? It's our neighborhood school or it's a private school. So yeah. I wish that we had more options.
And the schools are pretty diverse, I think, where you live, right?
So our particular neighborhood school is not all that diverse, but schools in Alexandria City are diverse. So certainly at the middle school and the high school level, they'll be very diverse. And I don't know that the middle school and the high school are, I think that they fall into the tracking and segregating by classroom track.
Okay. Topic number three.
DC and Chicago have made the news for high levels of truancy. In Chicago, 1 in 8 students in public elementary schools missed 4 weeks of class or more in 2010 and 2011. Why is this happening, and what can we do to reverse it?
4 weeks. This is on top of a new Fordham study that showed huge mobility rates in Ohio schools, and this surely is happening other places too. Kids are just coming in and out of these schools all the time. You must have seen this as a teacher, that you know the kids that you're teaching on day one may not be there on day 20, and they're not there by May. I mean, how do we deal with all this churn?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any easy answer, and I think that schools have attacked the problem in very different ways. I mean, I think you've got some KIPP schools and some Achievement First schools who literally, they will send teachers to go pick up students who are missing school too much and to say, come on, you're missing things. You need to come in. I think that parent choice has to be part of the solution here. I think that if we do a better job of empowering parents, they become more engaged. I mean, it's like when you ask people how they're feeling, they suddenly start to feel a little bit better. And I think that that can happen on the parent choice side as well.
You know, I think this is one area where us education reformers have to pay attention to some of the things happening outside of school. We get nervous of that. We don't want to create excuses for schools. But, you know, you got to wonder, okay, what's going on in these kids' lives that they're not showing up for school? Or in the case of student mobility, you know, what's happening with the housing system? You know, a lot of us grew up in a time when we saw these huge housing projects as a terrible thing, that they were just concentrating poverty. Glad when a lot of those came down, and the low-income families now are more dispersed. They've more of a private, more of a free market system of vouchers where they, you know, the downside though appears to be that a lot of these parents are chasing, you know, cheap rent all over a city, and they keep moving and their kids end up getting pulled out of school and going from school to school. I mean, so we got to figure out a way to, how do you make these schools stickier, you know, so that the kids stay there, they show up for school, first of all, on the truancy thing, and then they don't keep changing schools over the course of the year or even year to year. And that's going to be something that takes, that's not just an education question. I think it's also paying attention to what's happening in the housing markets, et cetera.
But isn't choice part of that, right? I mean, part of the reason if you're moving to get better rent or cheaper rent or better housing and you're forced to switch schools because of that, isn't mm-hmm. that part of the problem?
Well, but the Ohio data seems to show that there's a subset of poor parents whose patterns do not look at all related to quality or anything else. They're sure. moving, and some of them move in and out of different charter schools. I mean, what might help is if you had, say, in a place like DC where you've got a bunch of KIPP schools all over the neighborhood, maybe you can at least try to get them to move from one KIPP school to another. You know, there's hope that the Common Core stuff will create greater, you know, commonality. I mean, you know, another new book out this week by Andy Smerick, who's talking about, you know, turning all systems into charter school systems. This is one of these places where there's the downside is if we do have kids jumping around from school to school, you got to figure out how do we create, again, a system, some commonality, some supports, so that it's not just, you know, one completely different school to another. I mean, these kinds of things are tough. Mm-hmm. Okay. No easy answers on this one. Thank you, Pamela, for playing. We'll see more of Pamela in the future. You know, we should say Ty Eberhardt, who's been on the show. Folks will notice he's not here today. That is because next week he is leaving Fordham. We are very sad, but also proud. Ty is going to be a naval officer, a lifelong dream of his, and we wish him well and are proud of him for serving his country in that way. Okay, it's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. What you got for us this week?
A new study out by Susanna Loeb and colleagues. She examines teacher turnover and how it impacts student achievement. Popular topic. So earlier, Hanischek and colleagues found that less effective teachers tended to leave high poverty schools. So perhaps some turnover was beneficial. Remember that study?
I do.
This study says not so fast. Researchers examined testing and demographic data for fourth and fifth grade students in all New York City elementary schools over 8 years. Controlled for prior student achievement and a host of other variables. All right, they found that each year, roughly 1 out of every 10 fourth and fifth grade teachers in New York City either leave or come to a given grade level in a given school. So 1 out of 10, not terrible, but something. Okay. And they find that for a year in which turnover increases by one standard deviation, this corresponds with a decrease in math achievement by roughly 2% of a standard deviation, which is modest. Okay. Mm-hmm. Similar pattern exists for ELA, but again, it's even less than that. Further, the negative effect of turnover is larger in low achieving schools. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, the analysts mm-hmm. demonstrate harmful effects across all kinds of schools. So this is the little nuance here. So then they start hypothesizing that the impact of turnover is not confined to students who just have teachers who leave, mm-hmm. that the bystanders who have the teachers who stay could be impacted as well, perhaps through more systemic loss of teacher cohesion, mm-hmm. the curriculum's not being implemented mm-hmm. consistently across the school. So then they dig into the effects of turnover for stayers, movers, and rookies. Mm-hmm. They find that students of stayers perform significantly worse when turnover is greater. The negative effects, again, mostly appearing in low-performing schools. For students of movers, results are inconclusive, which we needed to know that.
Interesting.
And for rookies, no significant effect of turnover. So it's a head scratcher, right? Like, what do we make of that? Deserves more study, blah, blah, blah. Left with one thing, teacher experience, migration patterns, and prior effectiveness don't fully explain the effects of turnover. We're not exactly sure what does.
Well, so maybe the answer here is that it's all idiosyncratic, right? And it depends on the teacher, it depends on the school, how they handle it. I mean, look, we understand. I mean, here we are at Fordham. You know, we have, what, about 20 people on staff. That would make us a pretty small school if we were a school.
Yes.
But we know when we lose people like Ty, you know, there's transition costs. There's times when all of a sudden, you know, we're training up new people like Pamela. We're, you know, trying to adjust. We're discovering, oh my gosh, we didn't realize that Ty was doing a million different things and, you know, including cleaning out the refrigerator or whatever, and all of a sudden there's disgusting things growing in it. No, I mean, it has a broader impact than you think. And so any kind of churn is, but what you figure out is, as an organization, you figure out how you handle these things.
That's,
you know, what kind of training do you provide? How do you get people up to speed faster? Mm-hmm. How do you get, and these are just basic leadership and management challenges. And, you know, probably better, stronger schools with better leaders and principals handle these kinds of changes better, right?
Make for smoother transitions, which is what we're doing, right? Trying to come with a manual for everybody to sort of pass off with everything we can possibly think to write in this thing.
Right.
And I imagine the people that anticipate the transitions do a better job of dealing with it as well. Schools like KIPP have a ton of transition. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it would be interesting to see what the achievement effects are in a school that knows they're going to have a lot of turnover and plans for it versus a school who's maybe surprised by it.
You know, that's interesting. And I haven't, that's a really concrete kind of lesson you would think the KIPPs of the world could teach other schools. You know, we're really interested in this question. What can we learn from charters? That would be a good one to chase down, is how do you train people up as quickly as possible? What structure systems do you put in place?
Yeah.
You know, you know, again, is there something around curriculum that makes it easier or harder to get people ready
to
go?
Up to speed, right.
And up to speed and
strong. And expect it. Don't think, oh, surprise, we lost 10 teachers this year. No, you're probably going to lose X number of teachers. So this is what the process looks like.
Right.
Very nicely done. Thank you, Amber. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're back into a better season now that now the election's over. People are publishing studies again.
There we go.
Hallelujah. Okay, everybody, go see Lincoln. Let us know what you think, and we'll be back until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show and the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma, on sale now, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.